What kind of feelings do you have when you're reading your family, your last name on the wall near in Italy and in England? What kind of feelings do you have?
Well, to answer that other person, whoever it was, who knows, maybe. Never seen that. I have written a new piece, believe it or not, which I've talked to Sean about it, and it could possibly be an arena show, but that's down the road a little way. When you're talking about when I see my father's name written on there.
Yeah, because I have this.
Well, the tears are real. That's all I can tell you.
You know, it
was very moving to be in that memorial garden in Cassino. You know, and to see my father's name written on that tablet was deeply moving to me. As was, the letter that I read in the car is a letter that my father's commanding officer wrote to my mother, and he didn't actually send it until 1946. He wrote it in July 1945. But he'd been in a prisoner of war camp, and his name was Etheridge, and he was a marvelous man. I've done quite a lot of research on him since. And when he came back from being in the prisoner of war camp, since then, since 1944, he was there for a year and a bit. He decided that he was going to start a boys' club in the East End of London, because he having suffered as he had during the war and the army, he decided that he wanted to help young men, and he did. And in fact, it spread, and there became many, many boys' clubs, and he worked on it for the rest of his life, and he died a few years ago, age 94, having spent the whole of the rest of his life in service to others because of what he experienced in the Second World War. So hats off to Major Etheridge. He was a great man.
There's something interesting about the rest of that letter. There's another bit where he didn't send it. He says that he was sick, and now that it's known as PTSD and it's treated, and you know, it's people come back from war and they're just fucked. But in World War II, they would just come back and get thrown back into real life, and that was that. I mean, it's a different time. Knowing what we know now and seeing what those guys went through, it's insane what they had to deal with.
Next question.
Gap of time before you started this tour. What was it that prompted you to start the tour and to continue it so long to make sure to go everywhere in the world?
Well, we had done a tour. It's a long story. I can't get back to the beginning. But we did. Sean and I put together a tour before this. That was the Dark Side of the Moon tour, where we did Dark Side of the Moon was half of the show, and the other half of the show was other songs of mine, and then we did not put it. So when we finished that, I confess that, and that tour was extremely successful and opened up the potential maybe to do something else. But I confess, when we finished that tour, we all looked at each other and went, wow, that was great, and that's the end of it. And then I started to get the itch, you know, and think about possibly, and maybe not. And it was actually my wife, Laurie, who's sitting out there somewhere, I believe, who said, well, if you do go out again, there's only one thing you can do, and that's do the war. And I said, don't be stupid. I can't do that. That's a ridiculous idea. And then I thought about it, and I started asking old friends, you know, do you really think it would be possible to do it? And then I started ticking and thinking how to breathe new life into it. And it was Mark Fisher, the late Mark Fisher, who died last year, who was a great friend, who convinced me that if I did it, I had to physically construct a wall the same way that we did with Pink Floyd back in 1980. And I went, but how would that be possible? And he said, well, look, let's run the numbers and see. we decided it was possible, and that's when he and I started work on it with another good friend, Andy Jennison, who did a lot of editing work with us, and started putting the show together. Did that answer your question?
Also, I was just wondering why you continued for years and you went everywhere. That's
because you kept buying the tickets. And also because I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say, but it's a pretty good job. I mean, it's hard work and everything, but wow, when you're standing in front, we saw the people up there. When you're on stage performing, and for those people who are that connected with the work, and that you get that kind of a response, it's very hard to stop doing it.
Yeah, there were also two versions of it. It started out indoors, and the wall was, 250 feet wide, and then the success of it allowed it to grow and expand to double the size, and it allowed us to perform in front of crowds of 80, 90,000 people, which a lot of that footage is that big outdoor crazy extravaganza, so why not?
Spain or France?
Roger, did you have any ambivalence about going back and performing in front of stadium crowds, knowing that part of the influence for The Wall was the fact that you didn't like necessarily playing in front of those really mega crowds?
Because during the intervening time between 1977 with the famous spitting incident and when we went back on the road in 2010, well, you can do the math. It's a long time, and I've changed a great deal since then. And in my humble view, so have the audience. So there's much more of a symbiosis, a practical symbiosis now between me and the audience than was even possible in those days. However big the crowd is now when we go and do The Wall, whether it's in, the two big gigs that Sean filmed are Quebec, where we played at the Plan d'Abraham, and in Buenos Aires, where we played in the River Plate Stadium, and which is like 60,000 people, but there was nobody there having a party, they were having a party, but we were all together having a party. It wasn't like them off on their own having a kind of rock and roll party and shouting and screaming in ways that didn't feel great when I was a younger man.
Back here, Roger.
What's that?
They did, yeah. Oh, you remember that? Yeah, this gentleman was just saying that in Montreal, they let off fireworks when I was trying to sing something, and I got very upset about it. Shot it at the mic, as I recall. Yeah. Apparently there's a recording of that incident, so you can hear me.
Look at that poem, come on.
Okay, okay.
All the way back here, Roger. Set for Blurred Vision.
Hey, Seth, good to see you, brother.
How are you, my man?
I'm all right, thank you. Blurred Vision. This is been singing about the Ayatollahs in Iran and how they should leave those things alone.
That's right.
More strength to you.
We
have no truck for extreme governments, wherever they may be in the world. As I say in my little bit of broken French, when I'm talking about Jean Charles de Menezes, who was the Brazilian kid who was shot to death by the Metropolitan Police in London because they thought he might be a terrorist. So they shot him 8 times in the back of the head while holding him down on the ground in the tube train. And that kind of state terror deserves our condemnation, whoever it is, wherever it is, all over the world, as I say. So thank you for saying that.
It shows how important The Wall is, that it crosses all the boundaries of generations. That
is something that I wanted to ask you about, is how important it is that bands and rock and roll acts now from our generation speak out against the atrocities that are happening around the world, the way you've been doing all your life and so many of our heroes have been doing. How important is it for us to be standing up and speaking out, especially in an industry that sort of looks down upon speaking out against what's happening around the world?
Well, clearly my belief is that it's absolutely fundamental to all of our future and to our children's future and our children's children and their children. For as long as this small, fragile, flimsy thing that we call the Earth lasts, living as we do beneath the waning sun, it's super important that we all cooperate with one another to wring the last drop of life out of this existence. And if young people don't pick up the torch and carry it forward into the future, well then we can all drift into a miasma of decay and commerce, and wander around like zombies until we're all dead, and it's all over. I mean, the fact that some of the powers that be, particularly in the commercial world, are trying to convince us, for instance, that climate change has nothing to do with man, that it's actually the will of God, and these cycles have been following ice age and then a bit warm bit and then a cold bit for billions of years. And that the fact that people are prepared to believe it against all the evidence that we have, all our knowledge based upon the empirical evidence, absolutely goes to show that what these guys are saying, the naysayers, you know, Big Oil and the Koch brothers and all those people, is absolute nonsense. So everywhere, young people should be standing up and saying, that is bullshit, and we will not get a buy it. And we are going to change it. We're going to wrest the power from your hands and do something different. So, yeah.
It just so happens that on September 21st,
it's
National Peace Day. In New York City, in Times Square, Rolling Stone magazine with Avaz, tens of thousands are going to march for the global summit, the Global Climate Change Summit. And we are trying to hold the same thing here in Toronto. So if you're not marching in New York, Roger, we'd love to have you here in Toronto with us.
Well, thank you very much for that kind invitation. I can't leave it alone. I do not take that invitation lightly. I can't say a lot more about it. I sort of have a prior engagement somewhere in Europe where I'm doing something equally important in my view. But,
of course.
Okay.
Happy birthday to you, Roger.
Thank you. Let's see how the guys get on, you know, trying to find a distributor, you know, because this is not in our hands. We don't have that kind of power. My next project. I think that's enough movies just for tonight. Anyway. Listen, thank you all very much for being here.